Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 3 issues for just £5. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello and welcome back to Black's History Week. In this edition, Professor Jeremy Black, author of the forthcoming France, A Short History, talks to The Critic's political editor Graham Stewart about what made French politics and society distinctive in the 2 decades before and after the First World War.
Professor Jeremy Black, at the end of the 19th and beginning of the 20th century, there was in Britain the Edwardian Age, there was in particularly New York and the wealthier parts of the United States the Gilded Age, and in France there was the Belle Epoque. All these have in common a kind of sense of grandeur, of rather ostentatious wealth, of high living, of high culture. Were they all part of a similar phenomenon? What was particularly French and distinctive about the Belle Epoque?
Well, there was obviously a degree of specificity in each, and one might mention there are parallels, for example, if you'd gone to Vienna or if you'd gone to Berlin or indeed St. Petersburg. One thing that I would say about France, which is terribly easy to forget, is that Paris is also the capital of the second largest empire in the world, just as London was the capital of the largest. So in one respect, these are distinctly French or British. In the other respect, they are also imperial cities. And although by modern standards, they have a relatively low percentage of people from outside Europe, nevertheless, both Paris and London were fairly cosmopolitan and very wealthy. Now, the situation was, as you say, not necessarily the same across the country as a whole. If you'd gone to the industrial districts, you will find often great immiseration in both countries and indeed in the United States. And a lot of agriculture was a matter of low efficiency and low living standards. So what one might term the Belle Epoque is something that one should possibly think about in terms of just a tranche of society and a relatively modest tranche of society at that.
Yeah, so the average French farmer would have been bemused to think of what we now associate as the Belle Epoque as in any part of his life.
Yes, I think that's a very fair statement. I mean, I think as we mentioned last time, some of the big issues, such as, for example, the role of the church in education, reached very much into the localities of France, so that, you know, national agendas were not necessarily only a matter for metropolitan groups. And with rising literacy and the spread of the cheap press, and with matters such as military service, people were more aware, possibly, of the outside world than might have been the situation in, shall we say, 1830 or 1780. But nevertheless, I think one has to allow for a multi-layered set of identities, and in particular what the French call the pays, the local region, was very important to people's identity. Now, it wasn't the same as in Germany, where there remained, the German Empire was a federation, and places like Württemberg or Bavaria or Saxony, well, all of those three had their own kings and their own armies. But, you know, that as it were, underlined a sense of separate identities. Now, France was more similar to Britain in that respect, in that there was the notion of a nation state. But nevertheless, for most French people, with the exception possibly of military service for men, not obviously for women, The experience of life was often relatively circumscribed, both geographically and socially.
And how had parliamentary institutions, political institutions, developed by the first decade of the 20th century? How democratic was France?
Well, if you're thinking about the votes for women, not at all. If you're thinking about male franchise, all of the major states have moved towards a more inclusive male franchise, some more than others. I think the major restriction that one might argue in the case of French democracy, so-called, is more a question whether, as we discussed last time, many ministries were just a matter of, as it were, the reassembly of the same group of people, and that in a sense a political elite might be the wrong word, but coterie tended to often dominate matters. So to that extent, you might enjoy the vote, but the vote did not necessarily mean you have what I call democratization. I always distinguish between democracy, which is the practice of one person, one vote, or one person within limits. I mean, we don't give votes to 10-year-olds, for example. But, you know, one person, one vote, and democratization, which is the responsiveness of government, political systems and institutions more generally to a notion of what the people decide, it should be paid attention to. And you could argue from that context that democratization has always been much more limited in most states than democracy, and that France under the Third Republic was no different. I mean, I'd hasten to add, I'm not sure France under the Fifth Republic or Britain necessarily today is necessarily out of that issue and if you want to use the term struggle. But I would describe the French political system under the Third Republic as having democratic manifestations without, thought of in the British sense of that word, not the French, without necessarily having any real democratic system, if you see what I mean.
Mm-hmm. But the system that existed insofar as it did was votes for the National Assembly and presumably at local government level as well. How about the head of state? I mean, now obviously there are separate presidential elections. How was the head of state chosen in the first years of the century?
I wouldn't put the head of state as necessarily the key individual there. I would actually put more of an emphasis on the head of the National Assembly as often being the person who could move, as it were, political benefit round the system. The president varied. But what I would say about the president, and you know, I think there's to a certain extent, this is an issue that you're going to go on finding in many political systems, including France. The president was more involved frequently with both foreign policy, oversight of the military, and honorific issues than with what is often the key political matters. And I thought Zeldin brought this out very well, that a lot of the key political matters is the politics of the locality, in which your locality's ability to link to the most appropriate potent faction in Paris may well mean that you get support for funding a particular railway line from A to B, or for locating a garrison town with all the benefits that comes in place C, and so on and so forth. So there is an extent to which, although we think of France as very centralized in this period, a lot of the politics is really very local. And I take that a stage further. In my view, that remains the case in France. It's not to the same extent as in Germany, where you have, as you know, to this today, Germany is a federal system with the Länder. I wouldn't say it's the same as that. But nevertheless, again, this is, I think, trying to move aside from the formal constitutional matters to considering the actual practice of politics. I think local politics is very important. And what that does, I mean, and that is a reflection in part also, I should mention, compared to, say, England, as the very size of France. But also, what that does is enable a responsiveness in the political system, potentially. It could work sometimes, didn't always work exactly as you should anticipate, towards local political cultures and interests. And where things go wrong is when people feel, or we can debate what you mean by people in that particular sense, that they are not having their interests considered. But again, this reflects, in my view, what I would see as ancien régime French politics. If you go back, well back to the late 17th century, for example, there used to be, when I was a child growing up, the notion that France under Louis XIV, Louis XIV, was in some way an absolutist state, blah, 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 and people would talk about the intendances and all the rest of it. And then some rather good work came out. The American scholar William Bike was one of the most important in this field, looking at Languedoc, which pointed out that the average intendant had a staff of about 20. There were about 30, their numbers varied, about 35 at any one time of intendant. There were about 20 million French people. It was pre-census, but about that, maybe a bit more towards the end of the reign, and before the famines. And that, as he argued, and he very much focused on Languedoc, but comparable work appeared for some of the other areas of France, the intendant's power, and you can think, for example, more recently for the préfet, the prefect, is exactly the same. The intendant's power depended essentially on getting on with the local notables. If the intendant did not get on with the local notables, then they would essentially ignore him. And the intendant could give people instructions and they'd pay no attention. And to a considerable extent, I would say these continuities in governance are often more significant. I mean, I would say that's true of all countries, but I would say they were more significant as an aspect of French political culture than one tends to allow for. And there could be disruption. I mean, obviously, the terror and the dispatch of people from the center who were willing to terrorize the local potentates very much was a disruption. But in essence, there's not too much of an equivalent under the Third Republic. And the biggest disconjuncture that I would see is the debate over religion, because what was perceived, fairly or unfairly, as a republican assault on the Catholic Church, in the case of its powers over education and other matters, did resonate in some areas with a very hostile light as far as some of the local notables were concerned. Although, conversely, that, as it were, logic dynamic of politics was often used by Republicans as a way to seek to marginalize, discredit, limit their opponents. So you have the same sort of problem that you have in all political systems, that the state, and we can debate what we mean by the state in this context, might well seek, in order for its wishes to be implemented and in order for public order to be preserved, a reconciliation, a sense of consensus with the local elite as a whole. But politicized groups, both at the center and in the periphery, the regions, the localities, whatever term you wish to use, might well have a very different agenda. And I would argue you can see that in particular in the 1890s and 1900s, that what we mentioned last time in the Dreyfus affair helps to more widely increase political tension. But again, it's worth bearing in mind that there are parallels elsewhere. In Germany in the 1890s, 1900s, there's an increase of often very strident, sometimes racist nationalism, often linked with anti-Semitism. And, you know, you have to be wary always when you're looking at the countries of the period of either following a notion of which you look for a unique set of circumstances and pertain it to that country. And then somebody else points out with the emperor's clothes that exactly the same thing is happening 150 miles away. And what a surprise. But at the same time, you do need to look at the specifics.
Well, in terms of political agendas and parallels, international parallels, one thing that certainly strikes me about French politics, not only in the Third Republic, but at different times as well, is the fracturing of parties, groups that splinter and then ally and then change their name, change their identity. You compare that to the Republicans and Democrats in the United States, to the Conservatives and the Liberal Party, and then obviously joined by the Labour Party. Parties which exist for very long periods of time. What can we say about this French system where we don't have this continuity of institutionalised parties, but rather alliances that reshape and remould and change themselves and adapt and fall and rise again?
Yes, I think those are fair statements that you've made. I mean, what I would say in order to try and give a slightly more positive note is you can have what you're describing, which is a system of factionalism, but at the same time, you can have an inherent continuity and cohesion. So Japan under the Liberal Democrats in the 1960s, 70s and 80s was a good example of that, and in some respects not too different from the Republican factionalism of a lot of the politicians in France. And if in essence there are people who are, squabbling may sound too pejorative, but, you know, reforming coalition governments in order to pursue their own particular ends, as is happening, let us say, in Italy at this very moment, that does not inherently mean that when one talks about a new ministry, that you are necessarily going to have a change as abrupt as that you would see in Britain if you had a change between, shall we say, a Labour government and a Conservative government, or in the United States, between the Democrats and the Republicans. So I'm not sure. I mean, there was a criticism, of course, of the Third Republic, a bitter criticism, and you see that very strongly in the 1930s, the argument that, as it were, Republican government is corrupt and decadent and failing to address the character and will of the French people. And that argument, it sort of draws on what, again, we were talking about last time, which was the rise of right-wing ideas or far-right ideas in the late 19th century. And you recall I was discussing with you things like the cult of Joan of Arc and the very strong anti-republican sentiment of that period. I'm not sure that one necessarily should be so convinced that changes of ministry are themselves inherently a sign of failure. If you look at France in World War One, France changed minister on a number of occasions. You have as prime ministers people that you probably have forgotten, like Malvay, Ribot, Pontlevy. Malvay's the Minister of the Interior. These are people that you've probably forgotten. And in 1917, three ministries, the ones of Aristide, Briand, Alexandre Ribot, and Paul Pontlevy, all fell. Yes, and that was serious. I think it's worth saying that, to the best of my knowledge, you know, and of course the British government changed halfway through the war with the fall of Asquith. Correct me if I'm wrong, but the German government didn't change, and yet the Germans lost. In other words, a consistency of government is not necessarily the only measure of either success or failure. So I think there was a terrible tendency among critics to blame politics and politicians when in some respects, you know, there are obviously failings and inadequacies, but in some respects, politics and politicians are a symptom of a society with differing views and of a system, constitution, that allows the expression of those views.
Well, I wonder if we might talk for a moment about the left, the socialists, radicals more generally. How would you categorise the nature of left-wing politics on the eve of the First World War? We're talking about the period of Jean Jaurès. How important was a strong Marxist movement developing? What was the role of trade unions? Was it comparable to the Labour Party in Britain, or more like a German communist movement?
Well, I think you're right in looking at those parallels. You have, in the years prior to World War One, I think it's the SPD in Germany in 1912 is the largest party. You have the Liberal Party moving leftwards, I would say, in part as a result of cooperation with Labour, and in part in order to try and make sure it wins working class votes. And I would say in France, you have a coherent left-wing movement. But the key point, of course, is that the Socialist Party in 1914 is part of the Union Sacrée, the sacred union of all the parties behind the war. And I think that, in a sense, that is its most significant role. Now, you can debate with the other countries what would have happened but for the war. But I think it would have been extraordinarily difficult, if you'd assumed no war there, to have imagined that through democratic means you would have ended up with a socialist government in France, primarily because, as for example in 1848, so much of rural France was more conservative. Now, I think it's fair to say there are some areas of rural France that aren't conservative. One's got to be very wary of any monocausal explanation. But I think that there is a lot of France which is not as left-wing as you might imagine looking at the photographs of left-wing meetings prior to World War One.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's focus for a minute on one particular character, Jean Jaurès, the socialist leader who was an anti-militarist and was assassinated on the eve of the First World War. Did that assassination, is that one of the assassinations that changed history?
I'm always a bit worried about an assessment like that. I think it would have been very difficult for any political party to have held out for, as it were, not participating in the war once the Germans invaded in 1914. And if you think about 1918, I mean, the background in 1918 politically to the German so-called spring offensives is of growing Labour disagreement and growing socialist disinclination to the Union Sacrée. And yet what happens is when the Germans launch the spring offensive, there is, as it were, a rallying to the crowd, to the flag. So no, I'd be reluctant to put that kind of weight on it. I mean, you know, and as I said, I think the 1918 thing is absolutely crucial. I mean, in the socialists in 1918 launch a very strong attack on Clemenceau, who's the head of the government, in March. They formally abandon the Union Sacrée. The British are concerned that France will collapse. But political and public support for the war remains strong. And from what I remember, there's a big strike in Paris in May 1918, but it comes to an end because trade union officials, fearing both national defeat and revolution, move back from the brink. So I think coming at the crunch, no, I think it was not yet a situation that was as revolutionary as Russia had been with the communists at the end of 1917.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we should avoid the temptation to discuss the conduct of the First World War in any great detail, because that is a huge subject in itself, a lifetime study in itself. But perhaps we can focus on the political and economic consequences for France of that war. Politically, did it, by 1918, did it shift French, you know, the French centre ground towards the right?
Well, first of all, France was exhausted by the war. It had financially exhausted. It had lost an enormous amount of manpower. But on the other hand, Clemenceau comes through as one of the major figures. France gets a lot of territory in 1918. Now, one of the particular triggers of a move to a degree rightwards is not so much the war, but the aftermath of the war in the sense of spreading communist power during the Russian Civil War, but then also the movement of Russian forces and of communist agents outside Russia, most particularly with the invasion of Poland in 1920, but also, for example, communist activism, the Belakun takeover in Hungary in 1919. Now, the French take a very prominent role against the communists. I mean, France both intervenes in a major way within the Russian Civil War itself, sending troops, particularly to the Black Sea area, to the Ukraine, to Crimea. The French also play a big role in trying to organize the intervention of other powers. They take a big role in providing arms supplies to the Poles, fighting the Russians. And subsequently, they organize the so-called Cordon de l'Est, the sort of barrier of the East, if you like, which is a Eastern European alliance system essentially directed against Russia. Now, obviously, a international stance which is clearly anti-Soviet is one which at home correspondingly identifies communism as a threat to the Republic. And to that extent, I would say there is a consistency between French foreign policy and domestic policy in the early 1920s. I don't think you could have had one without the other. And again, I think it's worth saying that the same thing is true of other states. I think the same thing is true, for example, of Britain, that the Lloyd George government, which after all is predominantly conservative, is one which is both anti-Soviet and also faces quite serious labour agitation, major strikes, the deployment of tanks in 1919. So I think there is a commonality there that's worth thinking about.
And the sense of holding Germany to account, both in terms of blame but also reparations, that's something that is broadly shared across the political spectrum, is it? Or is there a difference between the Clemenceau and the Poincarés and the figures more on the left?
As far as reparations were concerned, you've got to bear in mind that the Germans had imposed, people tend to forget this, the Germans had imposed really quite stringent reparations on France in the peace settlement of 1871 and had gone on occupying France until that had ended. And indeed, reparations had also been imposed at the end of the Napoleonic Wars with a occupation as well. And, you know, I always find it rather curious that people stigmatize the First World War settlement and say it was overly harsh. And nobody thinks of saying that about the settlement in 1945, in which Germany was completely partitioned. And I'm not saying it was wrongly treated and for a second, but it was pretty toughly treated. So I actually do not think, there were arguments in France. Famously, Marshal Foch said that there should have been an attempt to create a separate state in the Rhineland. There were arguments in France that the settlement was too weak, rather than the opposite way around.
Mm-hmm. And you spoke a moment ago about France being exhausted, psychologically exhausted, of course, but economically devastated as well. Much of its most productive, industrial productive areas of northeast France had been devastated in the war.
Can I give you an example of that? I can recall some years ago going to give a lecture at what we spell and pronounce Reims and the French call Reims. And I can recall going to look at an exhibition of the war damage, from German shelling, which had absolutely devastated the area. And one of the things reparations was spent on was actually repairing it. It's worth bearing in mind that Germany itself, obviously many Germans died, Germany itself was singularly little damaged in the war. Germany had essentially fought on other people's territories, had devastated them cruelly, had killed civilians frequently, and had acted in a very arbitrary fashion. So it is not surprising that people took a view that was not that would subsequently suit Adolf Hitler. As far as casualty rates were concerned, 27% of all Frenchmen between the ages of 18 and 27 died in the war. And, that's a very high percentage. And as far as the total population was concerned, 3.5% of the total population died in battle itself. Now, this is, heavy. I've got here a comment from a visiting British civilian, Edward Heron Allen, who travelled the Bapaume Road on the 20th of October 1918. So that's close to the end of the war. He wrote, "The whole landscape seen on either side was a scene of complete devastation. As far as one could see to the horizon, blasted woods and ruined villages. I thought I had seen absolute devastation and ruin at Bapaume and Peronne. But Ypres, by comparison, is to the Sahara as the Sahara to a sand dune, etc., etc." And he goes on and talks about that. I think one has to understand that this was an appalling devastation. And quite frankly, given that circumstance, the actual peace terms imposed on the Germans were relatively modest.
Mm. To what extent was there a desire to return to economic orthodoxy, the gold standard, retrenchment or so on? Or was there a revolution in not in the military sense, but in economic thinking?
No, I think you're very fair when you talk about the return of the franc to the gold standard. That's exactly the truth. Fiscal stability was seen as very important by mainstream French politicians. But also, 1920s France is changing. Its economy, for example, you see the spreading use of the motor car. You see, as it were, as in Britain, both the old industries of coal, iron and steel but also the new technology of new transport systems, aircraft as well, and also consumer goods. And so I think it's worth bearing in mind that France itself is economically growing and recovering, albeit from a difficult circumstance in the 20s. And then in the 30s, of course, like many other countries, its entire economy, social system, and political order is put under enormous pressure from the disruption of the Great Depression. Because I think it's worth bearing in mind that obviously World War One had been economically devastating, but World War One had been a full employment economy, and as it were, inflation of the money supply, and the 1930s is an opposite on both those counts, and you know is enormously problematic.
And is there a comparison to the effect it had in Britain, where in 1931 there is a coalition of moderates, as it were, which is Stanley Baldwin and Ramsay MacDonald, and the country responds in a really rather small C conservative way, or is France really split down the middle between extremes of left and right, each with very different ideas as to how to solve the economic situation?
Well, there are both those extremes, as indeed there are extremists in Britain, of course, both communists and fascists. There are both those extremes, but I think they are, in a way, more prominent in France. And there is certainly a high level of violence. I mean, the Stravinsky affair, an embezzler with powerful political connections in 1933-4, that leads to... who dies mysteriously, that leads to real problems. A violent demonstration in Paris creates absolute chaos in 1934. There are the fascists in France are far more numerous. I think, I can't, you know, I'll have to look this up. I think the British Union of Fascists topped out at maybe 60,000, something like that. Mm-hmm. The Croix de Feu had 600,000, I think, by about 1934. And when in the end you get an attempt at a... solution from the left, the Front Populaire, which wins the May 36 legislative elections, I think it's fair to say that it faces a lot of problems. Now, I mean, it's true, and I think it's important to bear in mind that the left often presents its major problems as coming from the right. In other words, the so-called wall of money, which defeats the government, and also, of course, separately violent fascists. But I think actually one of the most important things is the Popular Front dissolves in 1938 because of the incompatibilities between the socialists and the communists, and the left isn't to return to power again until 1981. And in many senses, a powerful communist party which is being directed by Stalin is not the best basis for orderly politics or an orderly politics of the left in France. So you've got inadequacies and problems on the right, and you've got inadequacies and problems on the left. And on top of that, although the economy is not bad, it's not as strong in terms of its industrial sector. It's not as strong as either the United States or Britain or Germany, all of whom have a higher GDP per capita and all of whom have a larger industrial sector. So that again is a problem for the French. And then on top of that, you've got issues like its demography, its population isn't growing significantly, etc., etc., etc. So France has problems, but on the other hand, as I've mentioned, it's the second largest empire in the world still. and it is a significant player in international relations.
You mentioned a moment ago the Croix de Feu. Croix de Feu and other right-wing groups like Action Française, were they equivalent to a sort of a German far-right Freikorps, as we had in the 1920s in the prologue to the rise of fascism? Or are we wrong to try and find these German fascist equivalents?
Well, if you accept that German fascism or German far right is a broad movement with differing tendencies, then I think you could say there are parallels in France. But there are also significant differences. One of the major differences, I would say, in France is that most, but not all, on the activist far right have a strong Catholic tendency, and that is very important to their political identity and also indeed their animosities, their opposition to Jews, Protestants, Freemasons, etc. And I would say that the Hitlerian system or the Nazi system has a religion, but it's a religion that focuses on Adolf Hitler. So I would say that is a significant difference between France and Germany, and also that France doesn't have the equivalent to the myth of the stab in the back, the myth of Versailles, the revisionist attempt at international relations, and the notion of Lebensraum in living room expansionist tendencies in Eastern Europe. So I would say there are significant differences between France and Germany.
Well, you mentioned the failure of the Front Populaire in 1938 and Léon Blum's government. Édouard Daladier becomes Prime Minister and is with Neville Chamberlain in 1938 at the forcing through the appeasement policy of the Munich Pact. Is Daladier a French version of Neville Chamberlain, or is that a very superficial comparison based on their both being appeasers at Munich?
Well, I mean, I think all politicians are of themselves. I mean, I think it's fair to say that very few politicians of that period knew as little about foreign policy as Chamberlain. Who after all his background had very much not been in the area of foreign policy. I would say that Daladier and indeed French politicians in 38 and 39 were like their British counterparts in a very difficult situation with all sorts of imponderables going on, the extent to which Mussolini would back Hitler, and Mussolini was a particular threat to the French, challenge to them in the Mediterranean with his development of a modern fleet, and with France being strategically reliant on the link between North Africa and France. The way in which the Soviet Union was totally unreliable, as we know, the Soviet Union ultimately was to be the leading appeaser of all in the sense of allying with Germany and actually therefore effectuating a one-front war for the Germans. So I think it's a difficult situation. There are tensions and differences between France and Britain. The British interest in building up the RAF is one that in part is to do with a reluctance to deploy a large and significant force on a Western Front comparable to that which had occurred in World War One. There are differences between the powers, but given its context and given the fact that the French were worried about having alone to fight Germany, which had a larger population, and then Germany and Italy, and with a hostile fascist state allied to the two of those, Spain now on France's southern border. Given that situation, the French were playing a poor hand, and they were doing as well as they could.
So in that sense, you would say France on the eve of the Second World War. We often portray it as being led by exhausted people and defeatists, but actually they were making the best of a bad hand.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, I think they were in a difficult situation. And, I mean, you know, you can then take that. There's all sorts of stages you can take. I mean, for example, the Belgians and the Dutch, which were important to French security, but refused to abandon their neutrality. That, you know, was a institution. Strategic and political terms was difficult. The United States, unwilling to take any significant role in, or any role at all in restraining Germany. You know, these are really major differences and difficulties. And as you've mentioned already, there are political movements within France, the communists under the lead from the Soviet Union, who the Soviet Union becomes you know, allied to Hitler. Well, the communists, you know, as indeed in Britain, look to, you know, as it were, a Nazi triumph. And obviously the far right are also a totally and utterly unreliable. So, you know, there are major difficulties, and both the communists and the far right are more numerous than their counterparts in Britain. It's difficult.
Well, the German invasion of 1940 brings a denouement to the Third Republic, and that is the moment where we must leave it there for today. Professor Jeremy Black, author of France, A Short History, thank you very much. And next week we will pick up with France in the 1940s and in the post-war world.
Thank you very much.
If you've enjoyed listening to The Critic podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the offer of 3 issues for just £5 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.